So we're going to be looking at Psalm 46 and also just reflecting on Mark chapter 4 and verse 35, Jesus calming the storm. Sometimes marriages go through storms, don't they? There was a couple, husband and wife, were having some struggles. The husband was often frustrated because his wife would want his attention just at a point where he was concentrating on doing something, completing something. And they had many arguments over this until one day he said, look, just you need to wait till I finish what I'm doing and then I'll give you my attention. And so this one day he was doing a job in the shed and his wife came out and she just stood there waiting patiently and he was doing a job. And eventually the job was finished and he looked up and his wife said, the house is on fire. When we come to Jesus asleep in the boat, I suspect the disciples were not just waiting quietly, patiently until Jesus might wake up. No, they shook him. Lord, don't you care? Got to drown. You know, the boat. Here's experienced fishermen panicking. I suspect then that was a violent storm because they wouldn't normally panic. They'd be used to handling a boat in rough weather. And there's Jesus asleep. Not a care in the world. He seems to have no fear. And after he stilled the storm, still he says to them, have you no faith? Why do you fear? It's an interesting thing, faith, isn't it? As those who profess to trust Christ, sometimes we wonder, is our faith real? Or is it just whistling in the dark? You know whistling in the dark? It's dark and you whistle, acting as though there's nothing, you know, nothing worrying you, you're all calm. But underneath, you're terrified. Is that what our faith is, just whistling in the dark? I had a terror moment this week. Had a friend, Aboriginal friend, visiting Adelaide, and I had lunch with him. I had coffee with some of the fellas up in Blackwood, and I was to take him to the airport at 1:30. And we had plenty of time this time, not the normal, you know, last minute John thing. We had it all organised. Plane was leaving at 3:00. So we're getting there at 1:30, plenty of time. Go out to the car park where I'd left his bag in the little red car, and the little red car wasn't there. My wife had taken the little red car, and she'd also left her mobile at home, and she didn't notice the bag in the back seat. So we flew around Blackwood, and then we flew around. No, we prayed. We prayed. And my friend Raymond prayed, and I prayed. We trusted the Lord and we didn't panic. And there was no whistling in the dark. And I just thought, Lord, you know what's happened. You know what needs to happen. But as the time got closer to 2:30 and we still didn't find my wife or the car, there was that little bit of a, you know. And then when I rang the airport to say, well, look, it looks like we're going to miss this flight. Can we change the flight? And she's sure, 6:30 would be fine. How much more? $370? Now then my faith began to crumble. Lord, where are you? You know, has there been any point in our praying? But I tried to remain calm and trust that the Lord would get us out of this because there was some financial involvement now and it was all my fault. We got him on a plane the next morning and it was only another $70. And he said, actually, I wanted to hear Noel Pearson speak at the university. And so that's a great opportunity. Let's go and visit. I'll stay at my other friend, who's a friend of mine, an Aboriginal woman who was also in Adelaide with her son. And we went and visited. And we had a very precious time and a very significant time. And we both left that visit, as I dropped him off at the Adelaide University to hear this speaker, we both felt that God actually didn't want him to be on that plane. So my faith was there and it was trusting and then it was shaking and then it was there again, grateful and thankful that God's hand was over it all. Psalm 46 tells us that we are not to cave in, not to give way to terror and fear and panic when everything is falling around, because God is our stronghold. It's interesting, Martin Luther, and we'll be singing this hymn after the message, wrote a great hymn, based on this first verse, "A mighty fortress is our God." And it's encouraging to realise that he himself had times where he was tempted to panic, particularly when the Protestant Reformation looked like it was in danger of being lost. Luther would often say to his friend Melanchthon, "Let's sing the 46th Psalm." And apparently often when Protestants were forced into exile or when martyrs went to their death, they would often be heard singing this psalm. So it was a very significant psalm that spoke to God's people at that time through the 16th century when everything seemed at times lost, and they would turn to God and to this psalm. In James, in his letter, he says, is anyone in trouble here today? He says, pray. Why? Because God is our refuge and strength. He is an ever-present help in trouble. Here's a psalm for people in trouble. A more literal reading of the Hebrew is, God is for us refuge and strength. The emphasis is on God. In other words, for us, God is where we go for our security. He's our safe place. He's our shelter. He's our protection. He's the one who delivers us from fear and terror. In the face of all sorts of disasters and calamities, we have no other safe place, no other stronghold apart from God. And it's because God is on our side, it's because God is with us, that we can face whatever comes against us. Another psalm says, many are the afflictions of the righteous, but the Lord delivers them out of them all. Now sometimes he delivers us through them. He's an ever-present help in trouble, or as another translation says, a well-proved help in troubles. In other words, the psalmist is saying there's many times God's people have proven his power to help them in their troubles. So we know he's able to be there for us. He daily bears our burdens. Isn't that a wonderful verse? 1 Peter says, cast all your anxiety on him because he cares for you. So if you're in trouble, pray, because God is the strong fortress to run to for protection and safety. And God has unfailing strength. Without him, we would collapse under the fear. But we can stand with his power. We need not live in fear and anxiety if we know that God is our refuge. Now, that doesn't mean states of anxiety don't grip us. It doesn't mean that we can be struggling to hold on in faith. And it's not about how strong we feel our faith is. It's whether we look to God in the crisis, in the battle, in the attack. So the writer of Psalm 46 tells us that even if the earth gives way, we will not fear. So he's imagining the worst possible circumstances, a bit like, I don't know if you remember the disaster film, if you watch movies, 2012, where Los Angeles sinks into the ocean and the plane's flying with his family in between the collapsing buildings and the mountains going down. That's the picture that we have in Psalm 46. We will not fear though the earth give way and the mountains fall into the heart of the sea, though its waters roar and foam and the mountains quake with their searching. It's actually describing the kind of conditions that could result in a mega tsunami when a whole side of a mountain falls into the ocean. And it's exactly the situation where you would expect to be terrified. And yet we're told that those who know God will not fear though the whole earth give way. So he's talking about being fearless in the midst of great threat and calamity. I've known both in my life. I've known that faith that's kept me in great peace in the midst of crisis. And then I've known those moments where I have been in utter terror and panic and have not laid hold of God in the crisis. I've been there in both. And I know where I'd rather be. And by God's grace, that's where I have been at times. And it's been precious. To be in the other place is a place of such stress, such anguish, such terror, that it makes your whole body sick in the process. And it's where many people live. These verses describe moments when the creation actually seems to be unravelling. Remember in Genesis 1, we have the waters are gathered in one place and the land emerging out of the waters and becoming dry and habitable. But here, the opposite occurs. The mountains slip back into the water, into the sea, and disappear beneath the roaring waters. So it's like we're witnessing the reversal of the creation order, the disordering of nature, if you like, de-creation. And so even when God's good creation appears to be collapsing around us, we need not fear. Everything around us might be giving way, but we need not give way. So when the landmarks of our world seem to dissolve, when it's difficult to locate ourselves in the world, in our little world, we no longer need to fear. When everything's unrecognisable, all that's familiar is falling apart, we can still declare the Lord Almighty is with us. The God of Jacob is our fortress. And we're witnessing in our day moments when it seems people are trying to deconstruct morally the way God has structured the world, particularly in regards to gender. And so those things that have seemed, you know, solid and unalterable suddenly seem under great threat. And our very freedom to express what we believe about marriage and about what it is to be male and female is under threat. And what does the psalm say to us? Therefore, we will not fear. Though even these things give way. God is with us. God sustains us. We trust in his sovereignty. We have invisible means. It's not just pastors who have invisible means of support. It's the whole people of God. And it's not even just being fearless. It's actually being joy-filled. There's a river whose streams make glad the city of God. There is a river. That's a strange saying. There's a very quiet stream called Shiloh, but it's hardly a river. You see, one unique difference between Jerusalem and almost all other historical cities in the Middle East area is that it has no river. It has no river. Babylon has the Euphrates, and Nineveh, the Tigris, Rome, the Tiber, Jerusalem has nothing but a fountain or two and a little trickle and this little intermittent stream called Shiloh. And that's the problem with that is that when Jerusalem comes under siege, it has no ongoing supply of water. That's why they actually built an underground tunnel into the walled city, bringing some of that water from Shiloh in. But it could dry up. So how can the psalmist tell us there is a river that makes glad the city of God? Remember Jeremiah? He says that he said, Israel's committed two sins. You've forsaken me, and you've forsaken the fountain of living waters. You see, God is that fountain within the city. He's the source of their supply. Jeremiah says, tells them that they've gone elsewhere, actually. They've gone to Egypt, to the river in Egypt, which is a branch of the Nile, and they've gone to the river in Assyria. In other words, they've gone to these great empires looking for help, and all of them had a river which was symbolic of their power. Instead of them looking to their unseen, never-ending supply, God himself, they were turning to these other great rivers. That's what Jeremiah says. So what needed to happen is that the people of God needed to have their eyes opened to the river of God that was in their midst. There's a beautiful verse in Isaiah chapter 33. And he actually, verse 20, he speaks of a day when God's people would have their eyes opened and see the invisible security and supply that God gives his people. Particularly verse 20 talks about how God would establish Jerusalem as a peaceful abode, a tent that will not be moved, a secure city. And there the Lord, in verse 21, will be our mighty one. It will be a place of broad rivers and streams. No galley, no fighting boat with oars will ride them. No mighty ship will sail them. It's just a strange verse. That they will see this river in Jerusalem, a broad river. And it would have an advantage over the river of these other cities because no hostile fleet, no enemy, no ships could come and attack them. It would be an unseen river. In effect, he's saying, you can't see it, but if you will trust yourselves to God, there will be such a river. Now, there's times when we feel deficient. We feel dry. We feel empty. We look upon others as in their barrenness. And that whole bleak view of life takes away our joy. And we feel like we're in a dry and barren land where there is no water. But then God can open our eyes so that we see the river, so that we see living waters. Remember that Samaritan woman? Jesus opened her eyes to see living water. You see, Jerusalem was not a riverless city. There is a river that makes glad the city of God. Ezekiel saw that river beginning to flow, didn't he? And it became a strong river that no man could cross. Jerusalem had a supply if only they could believe it. Psalm 87, all my fountains are in you. See, there's someone who believed it. They knew that God would not fail them. They had a river like no other river. They had a source of life like no other city. Now, we might say, oh, yes, there will be a river and it'll be in the New Jerusalem. And you read about it, the river of the water of life, as clear as crystal, flowing from the throne of God and of the Lamb down the middle of the great street of the city. Yes, there'll be a river in the New Jerusalem. But what does John tell us at the end? He said, whoever is thirsty, let him come, and whoever wishes, let him come and take the free gift of the water of life now. Now by faith. One day we shall see it. And it won't be a literal river as we know it, but it'll be a true river because it'll be the water of life. Now this is all a riddle, isn't it? That's a river. You've got to hear the word of God with faith and with understanding that what God is speaking of are realities that are far greater than anything that we might know here. Whoever is thirsty, let him come and take from the free gift of the... Right now, we drink or we don't. John Newton knew of this river. He wrote that great hymn, Glorious Things of Thee Are Spoken, Zion, City of Our God. And then there's this verse. See the streams of living waters springing from eternal love, well supply thy sons and daughters, and all fear of want remove. Who can faint while such a river ever flows their thirst to assuage, to satisfy? Who can faint? There's times when we faint. We feel like we've got nothing left. We've got nothing to give. Well, you won't faint when you see such a river. Grace, which like the Lord the giver, never fails from age to age. So Newton saw this great river of God flowing from age to age, sustaining, renewing, supplying all the need of the people of God. A river that never fails. And it's all because God is within her in the city of God. Within the city, she will not fall. God is there supplying, sustaining. God will help her at break of day. Now, what's the city of God got to do with us? You know, Augustine wrote a remarkable book called The City of God. And it was written over many years. And it was written during a time when the church of that day was being overrun and threatened by barbarian hordes, taking over parts of Europe and northern Africa, where Augustine pastored and preached. And so it looked like Christendom was under attack, and it was. In fact, Rome, the eternal city, that's what they called Rome, the eternal city. Rome fell. The Roman Empire was crumbling, and they're actually blaming the Christians because you've led us to worship God, so that the Roman Empire became the Holy Roman Empire and worshipped God or claimed to. And they're saying because we forsook, we left our old gods, we're now paying the price. And so that's why Augustine wrote this book, The City of God. And basically what he's saying, not only that Christians were not to blame for the sack of Rome, because he showed that Rome had become the city of man, but also that the city of God was not threatened, because it was not Rome. It was the kingdom of God, bigger than any human empire. And the city of God could not be threatened because God was fulfilling his purpose. And so he actually writes of the city of man and the city of God. He says, not just the city of God is not just physical Jerusalem in Israel. Because we are looking for a city built not by human hands, but built by God. We're looking forward for the new Jerusalem to be revealed, which in some sense is also the church, because John says to the angel in Revelation, the angel says, I'll show you the bride. And John looks, and what does he see? The new Jerusalem coming out of heaven. So the city of God is actually something that we participate under God's solid rule in his kingdom. The city of man goes nowhere in the end. It heads for destruction. Its whole understanding of happiness, according to Augustine, is about the self, serving and living for the self. And that's emptiness. Whereas in the city of God, Augustine said, happiness, life, is found in God himself. Listen to this quote. How great shall be that happiness, that felicity, that's the word he uses, which shall be tainted with no evil, which shall lack no good, and which shall afford leisure for the praises of God, who shall be all in all. True peace shall be there, where no one shall suffer opposition either from himself or any other. God himself, who is the author of virtue, shall be its reward. For as there is nothing greater or better, he has promised himself. What else was meant by his word through the prophet? I will be your God, and you shall be my people. Than that God shall be their satisfaction, that God shall be all that men and women honourably desire, their life, their health, their nourishment and plenty, their glory and honour and peace, and all good things. In the city of God, happiness is found in God himself. So this is what the psalmist is talking about, the city of God that is eternal and secure. Meant to be Jerusalem, yes, but eventually, well, right through, Jerusalem ended up being the one who was the city of man, killing the prophets. And not coming to Jesus in the time of God's visitation, and he wept over that city. Can you see that the city of God had to be more than the earthly Jerusalem? It had to be a city that God would build and that would trust him, that would love him and look to him for its great supply and contentment and fullness and treasure and satisfaction. So this is the city of God that cannot fall and cannot fail because God will help her. God is within her. And so, yes, nations are in uproar. Kingdoms fall. He lifts his voice. The earth melts. In fact, it's God who is in charge. It's not just clever diplomacy by powerful presidents. If there's going to be peace in the Korean Peninsula, it will be because God's hand is on this. And that's what we should be praying. Verse 8, come and see the works of the Lord, the desolations he has brought on the earth. He makes wars cease to the ends of the earth. He breaks the bow and shatters the spear. He burns the shields with fire. It may be the psalmist is actually thinking about a time in Israel's history where God actually showed such power and brought an end to the threat that was upon them. There was one such threat in the time of King Hezekiah. The Assyrians were coming. Remember, the commander came and said, you know, no point trusting your God. He hasn't. Every city, every kingdom we've destroyed, they trusted their gods, didn't save them. Your God's not going to do any better. He ridiculed the God of Israel. And in fact, the Assyrian king sent a letter, and in that letter it said, surely you've heard what the kings of Assyria have done to all the other countries, destroying them completely, and you'll be delivered? Not likely. Did the gods of the nations that were destroyed by my forefathers deliver them? So Hezekiah, the king of Israel, reads that letter. And what does he do? He goes up to the temple of the Lord. He spreads it out before the Lord. And he says, Lord Almighty, the God of Israel, enthroned between the cherubim, You alone are God over all the kingdoms of the earth. You have made heaven and earth. Give ear, O Lord, and hear, and open your eyes, O Lord, and see. Listen to all the words Sennacherib has sent to insult the living God. It is true, O Lord, that the Assyrian kings have laid waste all these people in their lands. They've thrown their gods into the fire, destroyed them, for they were no gods but only wood and stone, fashioned by human hands. Now, O Lord, our God, deliver us from his hand, so that all kingdoms on earth may know that you alone are God. Isn't that a great prayer? Isn't that a great pattern for us to pray? Not because we got the Assyrians after us, but whatever we're facing. Lord, you show that you are God in this situation. And the next chapter tells us that the angel of the Lord went out and put to death 185,000 men in the Assyrian camp. When Israel got up in the morning, all the dead bodies were there, and the king of Assyria broke camp and withdrew. And you can understand then that as a result of that great victory of God supernaturally over this fearsome army, then that would have brought the end of many other threats to other places, to other kingdoms. He makes wars cease to the ends of the earth. He breaks the bow. He shatters the spear. He burns the shield with fire. Be still then and know that I am God. It's interesting. We often hear that as a, you know, be still and just quietly contemplate that God is God. But it's more a rebuke to the nations. Be still and know that I am God, that you are not God. I will be exalted among the nations. I will be exalted in the earth. In other words, those who oppose God should realize they're setting themselves against the living God. They should cease their raging and know that he is God and they are not. And God is the one who brings wars to an end. God is the one who could bring that storm to nothing so that there was no raging wind. The waters were calm. Be still. He actually rebukes the storm. Why were they fearful? Because they did not know that God was with them. The disciples did not yet understand who it was that was sleeping at the end of the boat. If the boat had gone down, what would have happened? If Jesus and the disciples had been drowned, that would be the end, wouldn't it? In terms of God's purpose, in terms of God's eternal purpose with this world. Was God going to let that happen to his son? No way. That's why Jesus could sleep. The Lord Almighty is with us. The God of Jacob is our fortress. And I love that. The God of Jacob. Remember Jacob? Jacob, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob. They were the fathers that God had given the covenant promise to. They all had invisible means of support. Jacob, right through his life, had that invisible means of God's covenant love and presence. But he didn't see it, did he? And so he was always relying on his own cleverness, always something up his sleeve, his own ingenuity to get out of trouble, to get what he wanted. He was always conniving. But in the end, he did come to know God as his refuge and strength. In a wonderful way, he wrestled with God and God blessed him and opened his eyes. And he came to know that God was his fortress, and that God alone could save him. So his confidence in himself had to be broken so that he could discover that he could be confident in God, whatever he faced. So the God of Jacob, not just the God of Abraham and the God of Isaac, but the God of foolish, conniving Jacob. He is with us. The God of Jacob is our fortress. When John Wesley was on his deathbed and he nearly lost his voice, his last words were this: the best of all. And he spoke it clearly and loudly: the best of all, God is with us. Even when everyone else fails us, the Lord is with us. Remember Paul in Timothy, he said that he'd been strongly opposed in his ministry, in his preaching. No one came to my support. Everyone deserted me. Do you ever feel like you're left alone? Paul did. But verse 17, but the Lord stood at my side and he gave me strength. The Lord stood at my side. The Lord was with him. Even when all human support seems to have vanished, the Lord is with us. I don't know whether you picked up in the song at the royal wedding that was sung by, I think it was called the Kingdom Choir. It's a song called Stand By Me. And I was listening to the words and I thought, ah, this is the psalm I'm preaching on. Listen to the words. When the night has come and the land is dark and the moon is only the light we'll see, no, I won't be afraid. I won't be afraid just as long as you stand by me. So darling, darling, stand by me. I stand by me. If the sky that we look upon should tumble and fall, or the mountain should crumble to the sea, I won't cry. I won't shed a tear just as long as you stand by me. Stand by me. Darling, stand by me. That's what we do sometimes. We look to someone whom we love and we think their love's going to hold us. Well, sometimes and sometimes not. Because they're not God. You see, this song is actually a love song, but it was adapted from an earlier spiritual gospel song, which was inspired by a hymn written by Charles Albert Tinley. You can do all this research. I love it. He's an African-American. He was the son of, his father was once a slave, and he worked as a janitor, a cleaner, at the church of which he later became the pastor. So he was the cleaner of the church, and he ended up being the pastor of that church, and under his ministry, that church grew to 10,000. What a remarkable ministry. This is in 1905. And he wrote many hymns. And these are some of the lines from this hymn. This is more than a love song to you, darling. When the storms of life are raging, stand by me. When the world is tossing me like a ship upon the sea, thou who rulest wind and water, stand by me. In the midst of tribulation, stand by me. When the hosts of hell assail and my strength begins to fail, thou who never lost a battle, stand by me. In the midst of faults and failures, stand by me. When I do the best I can and not my friends misunderstand, when I do the best I can and my friends misunderstand, thou who knowest all about me, stand by me. In the midst of persecution, stand by me. When my foes in battle array undertake to stop my way, thou who saved Paul and Silas, stand by me. When I'm growing old and feeble, stand by me. When my life becomes a burden, stand by me. When I'm nearing chilly Jordan, O thou lily of the valley, stand by me. That's a stronger word, isn't it? Than darling, remember me, or stand by me. When everything's looking as bleak as possible, we cry out to the one who's Lord over the storm, stand by me. There are times when our life is falling apart in all sorts of ways. It can be our health, it can be our finance, it can be relational struggles. It can be crises that come out of nowhere and suddenly we're in a place where we don't know which way to look. And we need to simply say, stand by me, and know that the God of Jacob is with us, the God of Jacob. The Lord Almighty is our fortress.